You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Today is Wednesday, August 13, 2025. I'm here with Dr. Chandran Kukathas, who's a chair in political science at Singapore Management University and a distinguished fellow with the F.A. Hayek program here at Mercatus. He is a leading political theorist known for his work on liberalism, multiculturalism, and the political thought of Hayek. Some of his books include The Liberal Archipelago, Immigration and Freedom, and what we're talking about today, his new book, Dialogues on Immigration in the Open Society, which was published in 2025. He also served as department chair at the LSE and as a dean at Singapore Management University. Chandran, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks, Pete. It's great to be here.
Why tackle this book, this topic, in dialogical form, and what writing challenges presented themselves to you in writing a book in this way?
The initial inspiration for this came simply from an offer from Routledge, or a request. They had started a series of philosophical books in dialogue form, which they wanted to use for undergraduate teaching. And so they invited me to really do another version of my earlier book, Immigration and Freedom. I said that I wasn't interested in repeating myself, but the dialogue form sounded very intriguing. So I said, let me write a couple of chapters and see, you know, whether that would work. I sent it to them and they liked it. And so I wrote the book. And as for the challenge of writing in the dialogue form, it was super easy. I found it just came so naturally. I knocked out a couple of chapters in a couple of weeks. I just sat there on my laptop and typed away. And, you know, I knew all the empirical side of things, and I knew the philosophical arguments in question because I'd written a very, very big book published only 3 years before. So yeah, it just flowed out. And then there were breaks simply for lack of time when, you know, I was doing other things. But when I had time again, I just sat down and wrote it. I didn't plot it out. I didn't structure it other than in the very loosest sense. I just sat down and wrote it.
Well, I found it very refreshing because a lot of times when people do dialogues, it's a little bit of a manipulative conversation in which the person who is the leader is manipulating the conversation. That didn't actually appear in here. And then sometimes, you know, you'll take one of the characters will be the ideal type of the quote unquote right position, and then they become preachy. You know, you think about other dialogue forms. The most extreme form, of course, would be like Ayn Rand's, you know, speech in the middle of a wedding or something about this. And so I found it very fascinating, the sort of constraints. I want to get to the substantive questions, but I was very intrigued by your teaching style. I consider most of the stuff that we do as writers, even a big serious scholarly work like you did with Immigration and Freedom, they're a form of teaching. You know, it's different audiences that we're teaching to our peers, teaching to, you know, undergraduates or whatever in this. So I was very fascinated by your teaching style because as the philosopher, you insisted on conceptual clarity about a lot of the issues, but it wasn't conceptual clarity to reason them to your position. It was that so they could ask better questions about things. Is that your approach in general of how you go about doing things?
It is, I think, my approach in general, particularly with teaching. But I think even more broadly, I've never really liked the idea of preaching to the converted. Yeah. And so I've always been inclined to try to see the other side. And if I find this with my students, say they start to agree with what I'm saying, I just naturally inclined to try to find the counter-argument and put that to them. I think it's probably something to do with my nature. I think if we're all sitting around agreeing with one another, it can get boring very quickly. So when I wrote the dialogue, the objections came more or less naturally. I didn't have to say to myself, okay, I've got to think of an objection to this. I simply wanted to engage with the interlocutors in the dialogue in the same way that I would engage with my students. I used to say I'm a teacher, not a preacher. I don't like to just try to convince somebody of something. Unless I'm giving an academic paper, then I think it's your job to defend your position. Yeah, no one else is going to do it for you.
I think that one of the things that comes out in the book is, how charitable you are to all the different points of view. You give each of them their voice, and not that they're silly in having the view. You know, one of the things that struck me, I mentioned this to everyone, you know this, I was a student of Buchanan and Tulloch's, and I always contrast the difference in their style, because Buchanan ended every class with a question. Every class, it gave us a question to ponder for the week. People would ask him, Professor Buchanan, what's the answer to that? And he'd say, I don't know, because if I knew, I wouldn't have asked the question, right? Gordon Tulloch ended every class with a declarative statement, like, this is the line, you know? And there is a difference in their style that comes out, quite clearly, I think, and gets lost. And Buchanan was always trying to get us to ask the right question. Or better questions, not right questions, better questions. And I think that's what you're trying to get the students in this dialogue in your various, meetings with them. You're trying to get them to ask better questions.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm very much in the Buchanan camp. I think I've also, in this regard, been very influenced by F.A. Hayek, because I think his paper on two types of mind, I think it's called, and he describes himself as more of a puzzler than the master of a subject. So he was always trying to figure it out and always a little bit uncertain of himself. And I think that's me by nature. But also I'm just wary of people who've got the answers. I mean, in some ways, I really do admire those who have that kind of command of a subject. But I think that's just not me. I'm really much more someone who is, I'm always looking to find out what the counter argument is. So if I see a thesis that I find that I'm really attracted to, or something that really confirms my view, if I come across a book or an article that does this, the first thing I usually do is now just Google reviews and see what the objections are, because I guess a part of it is also that, I don't want to be a chump in the end, ended up buying into something because it suits my thinking, only to find out later, this has been completely discredited somewhere. So
I don't fully agree with, Richard Feynman's, depiction of what the scientific process is, because it's more or less a 3x5 card idea, hypothesis, test, reject, or whatever. I think science is much more complicated, but I think he captured the scientific attitude the best. He, in two ways. One of them, he said, the easiest person to fool is ourselves. I think that's true. And the second one was, he said, never fear asking a question that can't be answered, but always fear an answer that can't be questioned. And I think that's a very, very important aspect of all of this, which, and I should point out in the book to the listeners, is that you have a footnote record in this book. So it's done in the dialogue form, but you have a footnote record which is deep into the scholarly literature and basically tracks each of the claims so people can, you could learn the whole aspect of the subject by going through and studying through the footnotes as well as reading the dialogue. Let me ask you another question about your conceptual clarity issue, because it affects the way you argue about certain positions in the dialogue. So what I mean by that is, because you're stressing conceptual clarity, you examine concepts like civilization or the state, or even in your economics chapter on the Pareto improving quality of things, and you demand that the if we insist on conceptual clarity, the coherence of the concept kind of collapses. And so that takes away some of the criticisms that people are having about, oh, civilization is under threat. And then you're asking the question, well, what's civilization? And what do you mean? It's always this thing. Can you elaborate that a little bit? Because it's a very interesting use of conceptual clarity to then explode naive versions of coherence.
Yeah, I think there are a few different things I'd say. One is that my earliest teacher in political theory, a guy called David Band, used to emphasize the importance of this when I was an undergraduate. And he did it, you know, so often that it kind of stuck with me that this was important. So that's the personal side of it. The other thing I'd say is that in looking for conceptual clarity, I'm not trying to suggest that concepts are somehow fixed. And so if we can just get the concept right, then we can sort all the issues and the problems, because concepts change all the time. Our understandings of words evolve. And, you know, we can use the same concepts for different purposes. So the important thing is to be clear about what it is that we have in mind when we use these concepts. So in the dialogue, there are a couple of things I was concerned about when emphasizing the importance of conceptual clarity. One is that people often use words without having much thought about either what they mean by the word or what the listeners might mean by the word, because it's no use, even if you're very clear about it, if you're using it in a way that, you know, the listener is not going to understand. So you've got to make the concept clear, whether explicitly or implicitly, so that you are on the same page with your listeners. So if you talk, for example, about an existential crisis of civilization, it's important that you be clear what it is that you've got in mind. Are you talking about the globe? Are you talking about the nation? Are you talking about Europe? That's got to be clear. And if you're going to talk about the collapse of a civilization, what exactly is it that you've got in mind? The Roman Empire collapsed, but it took 800 years. What does that mean then to say collapse? I think all of these things have to be made clear. That doesn't mean that they have to be made explicit, because we can't spend all our lives in conversation, you know, prefacing everything we want to say with, let me first tell you what I mean. But as you converse with someone, you should be able to answer when someone says, well, what do you mean by that? You've got to have a reasonably clear idea about what it is that you've got in mind. So that's one thing I think is really important with, you know, with the idea of conceptual clarity. But as I said, it doesn't mean that what you're trying to do is find out the definitive answer to this question. And this brings me to the second thing, really, that is that I think so often when we engage in debate or discussions about, say, things like immigration, we take it for granted that we know what something like immigration means. And all the work that we do to making the argument about immigration presupposes a certain understanding of it. But actually, what needs to be investigated first before you can make claims about whether immigration has these effects or those effects or these benefits or those benefits, you've got to be clear about what it is that you mean by immigration. And I think in a lot of social science, the real work that's going on is not in the empirical testing. This goes to your point, but Feynman saying, you know, first you get the hypothesis. Well, there's an awful lot of controversy that goes into the framing of the hypothesis, because framing the hypothesis means bringing forward conceptualizations of things. Okay? So if you're going to say, you know, immigration leads to this, well, what do you mean by immigration? Do you mean anyone who's crossing the border? Or do you mean people who are moving permanently? Do you mean permanently as in a year or longer? You know, what is it that you've got in mind here? Is it just crossing the border, or is it something else? And until you've framed that clearly, all of your testing is essentially predicated on a conceptualization which others may not recognize or accept. So that's why I think it's really important.
Well, I think this is the reason why being able to ask the question is so important. Feynman has this famous video of him giving a lecture about the scientific method. And he has on the first stage of the hypothesis, he says, this relies on a guess. And all the kids in the audience laugh. And he says, no, that guess is the most important thing. But he leaves that unexamined in his discussion because he's more associated with the procedure and the idea that there's nothing sacrosanct, right? Which is he's going to then. But I think that first part, that is really what Hayek and others are sort of trying to get us, and what you're trying to do here, which is that what question we ask. Methodology dictates not only, what we consider to be a good answer, but actually what's a good question to begin with. And so it's one of the reasons why they focus on it. And one of the things I found really, quite fascinating in this way that you use this idea of trying to get the conceptual clarity is that it applied to all of your interlocutors. So there's a character in your book, Tracy, I think is her name, and she's kind of the conservative interlocutor, anti-immigration, wants to preserve Western civilization kind of idea. And so, she's going to be your first person that you sort of say, like, what civilization, all these things like that. But it's also true that other people that have different views about, say, obligations to the poor or whatever, they also are subject to the same kind of idea. So all the positions are forced to ask better questions, I think. And it's a very subtle book in this sense. Compare that to, say, my colleague Brian Kaplan, who writes a much more like blunt force instrument book. When you sit down to think about that, how do you weigh the costs and benefits of the various literature that's actually on your side in some broad sense, but is done with a much more blunt force kind of argumentation style? Do you find that not as effective or effective only under some audiences or what?
I like, Brian's take on a lot of this, but it's always struck me that something like that is going to be much more persuasive to someone who basically is already almost in your camp. So the advantage of it is it gives you a certain amount of ammunition with which to, engage other people. But I think it's very unlikely to persuade someone who is indifferent, let alone hostile to the position, because it's not a position or a way of approaching things that emphasizes finding common ground. It essentially says, here are the premises, now here I'm going to deduce everything. But of course, all the deductions are implicit in the premises. So if you've already accepted the premises, then it's just working out. Whereas I think what I would like to do is not so much persuade people of the answer as to cast doubt on their reflections on this. I remember Milton Friedman, in the introduction to Free to Choose, said something like, I'm not trying in this book to persuade you of these conclusions. Anybody who can be persuaded by reading one book can be persuaded in the other direction by reading another. So, the important thing is to make you stop and reflect. And of course, I'm not without views of my own, so I've got things to say that I would like you to take into consideration. But, I think if I just say, here are the premises and here are the conclusions, take it or leave it, I think a lot of people are going to say, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, you get to that at the end, but I want to sort of describe the book a little bit. It's made up of these various different conversation moments. So starting with a conversation that just takes place at the, at the university and then eventually in your home and in the story. But you discuss the issue of immigration and culture, immigration and economics, immigration and the state, question of the refugees, and then finally the relationship between immigration and the open society. So maybe if you could just, you have a whole book of this, but if you could just maybe briefly summarize some of the main points of the conversation in each of those, then maybe we can like play off of that conversation some, I think.
So the book begins with the students accosting the professor who's about to go on sabbatical leave, and they discover that he's about to write a book on immigration. So they tease him about the fact that he's a philosopher and all he does is examine concepts. And so he, you know, they have a conversation, and it's clear that they have their own views. And one of those views expressed by Tracy is that there is a kind of existential crisis if we don't control immigration. So this leads into the discussion of, you know, what exactly is the nature of the crisis? What do you mean by culture, by civilization, by all these things that you worry about? And in the beginning, the students are fairly confident about their views. And, you know, in this first chapter, what the professor does is he starts to gently undermine some of this. And so he ends by saying, look, if you really want to examine this more closely, you'd have to do some work. I'm happy to meet with you, say, you know, once a month for the next few months, and you can do some serious preparation, come in and defend a point of view, and then we'll discuss it. So that leads to the next chapter on economics. One of the students defends a certain kind of view of immigration and immigration control. The next chapter, I think, is the chapter on the state. The most conservative of the students there defends a view that, you know, it's important to protect and establish the state for the purposes of stability, and therefore immigration control is central to this. So this gives us an opportunity to consider, you know, what you mean by stability, how much stability you need, what do you understand by the state, you know, to what extent is some kind of theory of nationality important here. And of course, in the process, the whole conceptualizing of the state comes under question. It's not rejected, but I think all the students say, okay, this is a lot more complicated than it seemed, because it looked like, you know, they all knew what they meant by the state and how it's going to be kept stable and so on, and it turns out that they're not quite as clear as they thought. So then we go on to the issue of rights and refugees. Some try to say that, okay, we should make an exception for refugees. Cave, I think, says to everyone, yes, we should have, you know, open borders for the refugees and the rest pay cash. But that's a way of examining one very specific issue within the whole debate about immigration. It's not the only specific issue, but it was one way of illustrating a particular kind of point. And then the students basically say, look, you know, it's time you say what you think. And so in the final chapter before the epilogue, the professor offers his own take on what a free society is. And this is the theory of the open society.
Right before the professor's leaving.
Just before he's leaving, yes. And there's a bit of autobiography there, obviously, because the professor tells him at the end that he's actually quitting and moving to Greece, which is what I'm about to do. So they're all very kind of puzzled about this. So they agree to come and farewell him before he leaves. And that's the epilogue.
No, that's great. One of the themes that is throughout the book is wrestling with the question of justice, because people bring it up, and also questions of consequences. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Because to some extent, you also tear away some of the coherence about what is just, and, you know, also raise questions about what they think or they're so confident about in terms of consequences, but it turns out that it's more complicated than that. So just give a couple examples, maybe.
Yeah. So this aspect of the book stems a bit from my own thinking about justice and the usefulness of not just the concept, but the use of this notion as a way of framing issues or debates in political philosophy. I mean, ever since John Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, came out, most of the debates in political philosophy of a general kind have been framed in terms of justice. What is the just thing to do? So it's fairly natural for some to say, well, we should consider justice in immigration. And I wanted to say in this book, as I've said elsewhere, I don't think that justice is the best way to think about the nature of a political order. And the reason for this is that justice is a very demanding moral notion. And in politics, I think what we've got to figure out is how we live together, given that we've got different moral convictions. And these include convictions about justice, as well as, of course, convictions about, you know, political institutions and so on. So this is the liberal in me coming out. I think the liberal response to this is, well, we've got to find a way of accommodating different ethical convictions. And given that so many of these ethical convictions are convictions about justice, what we need is some other kind of way of framing things. And so to have a conception of justice which is very substantive is simply going to be a kind of recipe for making all of your debates intractable. So to say that, you know, a view about immigration is going to rest on a theory of justice would in a way make the theory of immigration hostage to this larger issue or larger problem. And I wanted to avoid this. But in the book, what I try to do is look at the different views about justice that the students advance and say, well, look, you know, here are all these problems, and you know, you yourselves can't agree about these things. Maybe immigration is not a matter of justice. It's not that there's no right and wrong about many things that we want to talk about. We could all have strong convictions about this. But what do we do when we actually disagree? Now, this is not to deny that, of course, many theorists who've written about justice, John Rawls included, are fully aware of the problem of moral disagreement. Okay? But they still want to frame the resolution of this under the rubric or under the framework of a theory of justice or concept of justice. I've argued that that's not the best way to do it, because justice by its nature is much more demanding. So in other things I've written, I've tried to suggest that, you know, what we need are institutions that emphasize the importance of, you know, toleration, recognition of pluralism, recognition of diversity, and so on, but not focus on justice.
Again, I think that the book conveys a very readable way to discuss these issues, which in your other works you've done, and but also, you know, reaching back to other people, like we mentioned before, Hayek and Buchanan, and or Adam Smith for that matter, and issues about what justice is a, you know, is it an obligation that what we owe to one another, or is it a set of rules under which we can live better together, kind of idea. And you do a great job of doing that, because each of the arguments at some point have some notion of justice that they're trying to make for their position. And so it's based on what you just said, where their defense of immigration would be based on or their position on immigration would be based on some notion of justice. And then it sort of gets back to another way, which is literally, how is it that we can live better together than we can ever? Okay, so here's the real difficult problem, and the importance of this book and the timing of it is that the timing couldn't be better for the topic, but unfortunately for the world, we have moved in a backlash against cosmopolitan liberalism and the idea of strangers nowhere in the world. You know, I was wondering if you could give some example. You don't really talk in the book about concrete examples. It's in the background of people's heads, so there's a timelessness about the book. So it doesn't just mention this UK policy or this US policy or whatever. They're there, but you don't go through into the details or whatever. But in your own mind, can you think of like current policies that you've been studying that you find particularly problematic in Europe and the United States and Australia or wherever, right? So in this backlash.
Well, I see problems with policy, as you might guess, everywhere, because of the growing hostility to immigration. I mean, if you think back, say, you know, 30 years ago, when I think George Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan were debating immigration, or debating really for the candidacy for the presidency, the candidacy for, you know, the nomination to be the Republican candidate. And they were both arguing about how the other was not pro-immigration enough. You know, we're in a very, very different environment, which is not to say that, you know, back in the 1980s, there were no immigration concerns. I mean, this is, only a few years before the Immigration Reform Act of 1986. So, you know, it's always been an issue. But I think there's been a general background understanding, both in the population and the elites, that immigration was not in itself, you know, a bad thing. Immigrants were not demonized. There were still worries about people moving illegally, but, you know, the issue is how to make movement possible in alignment with national interest, let's say. In places like Australia, there was generally, you know, a very welcoming attitude to refugees, because this was in the period in the early 1980s, you know, after the outflow of Vietnamese refugees, in particular after the fall of communism. You know, it was a much more welcoming time. Now, you know, fast forward to Australia, over the last dozen years, refugees have become much more demonized, especially by various governments. They've taken extraordinary measures to stop people from landing on the shores, because Australia is a signatory to the 1951 Refugee Convention, which obliges you to hear anyone's asylum claim if they land on your shores. So what they've done is they've pushed out brought in the boundaries in the ocean, stopped people from landing on Australia's shores, shipped them to other countries, and then processed them from there. The outcome has been more or less the same, in that, you know, everyone who's been processed is almost always turns out to be a refugee, but the optics is very different, you know. And so for the public, this now looks like these people are somehow bad people, that what they're doing is they're protecting Australia's borders. Of course, most people who arrive and claim asylum arrive by plane. The vast majority of them do. But the worry is not so much the actual outcome of the policy, or even the expense, because it's costing them about $1 million per refugee. But it's, you know, the kind of change in people's attitude. All that said, you know, in Australia, people are generally still very pro-immigration. I mean, 70%, I think, the last survey I saw was pro-immigration. Very different, I think, in Europe and in the United States. If you take the refugee issue or the illegal immigrant issue, great deal of hostility to them. Now, what's, I think, you know, disappointing, unfortunate, sad, is that I think a lot of this is the product of very ill-considered policies over a long period of time. Of course, there are a lot of people, you know, arriving by boat. Of course, there are a lot of people, you know, landing on Britain's shores, for example, and creating all kinds of problems then administratively, legally, you know, and creating enormous amounts of anxiety in the population. But if you think about why it is that this is happening, you know, the numbers in absolute terms aren't that great if you think about the population of Europe. But the Europeans have not figured out a way to address this. They've not figured out a way to make legal avenues for the movement of people possible, in which case, you know, people are pushed into these illegal avenues. If European foreign policies contribute to, you know, a refugee outflow or an asylum seeker outflow, or just an outflow of, you know, people seeking to move from wherever they are, they're going to find illegal means. So, you know, the strategy that they've adopted, I think you can simply say straightforwardly, it's obviously not working. Okay, but all they're doing is just doubling down on this, and then further policies make everything even more difficult. I mean, for example, if you come to Britain and you want to claim asylum, you'll be given an opportunity to have your case, you know, go to the courts. In the meantime, you're housed in some sort of place, a hotel. you're not allowed to work. There's a labor shortage everywhere, but, you know, all these able people are not allowed to work. They're costing the state money. People are upset about their taxes going up. Everything about this seems wrong. And I'm not going to, you know, turn around and say, okay, here is the solution. But clearly someone's got to be saying, look, this is not working. And the idea of just saying, look, we've just got to double down and, you know, do it better doesn't seem to be a sensible view. In the book, I have Tracy continually say, what we need is political will, you know. But you know, the rest, including the professor, say, okay, well, here's the objection to, you know, to this proposal, here's the objection to that proposal. All these things are not working. And I think the same is true in the United States. People are still flooding in. Okay? There's really only one way you can absolutely be sure that you will reduce the number of people coming into your country, and that is to become poor. Okay? I mean, it's very clear that when unemployment goes up, immigration goes down, because people are looking to move somewhere to work. Maybe, you know, the next few years of American economic policy will have, you know, that salutary effect. We'll see what the effect of all the tariffs and things are. But that's, you know, the critical thing. You can't control something like this. You know, if you think you cannot control the entry of drugs into prison when you've got actually literally walls all around, how are you going to control, you know, thousands of people who want to cross the border? And the last thing I'd just say on this, because this is rather a long answer, one thing that people, I think, don't reflect upon enough is the extent to which people move to a country because people inside the country want them. And they don't just welcome them when they arrive. They go out looking for them. You know, employers go looking for workers because they need them. You know, other American citizens look to bring their friends or their, you know, relatives, or, you know, there's a demand for it, you know. And I think so much of policy is simply trying to cut off the supply. Well, you know, I think any economist will tell you all that does is it just drives up the price, right? And I think that's one of those things, you know, in current policy everywhere, I think that's insufficiently appreciated. Why are you just addressing the supply side?
There's a lot to unpack there. We'll get to some of this stuff when I ask you about your book, Immigration and Freedom. But, you know, it's a very interesting observation that you made about Reagan and Bush and the rhetoric at the time, because that's actually the rhetoric of the self-understanding of the United States for many years. You quote a few times in the book the phrase at the bottom of the Statue of Liberty and the full line, which I'm not going to be able to remember right now, but you can.
Give me your poor, your tired, your huddled masses yearning right to breathe free.
If you look at the very beginning of Free to Choose, the video, the TV series, it starts with immigration. That's how Friedman started, about how people came here with nothing in their pocket and were able to make a better economic life for themselves, because we ourselves are all immigrants in some sense, right? Friedman's family came from Russia, you know, and moved over here and then be able to make, you know, a life for themselves here that they couldn't make for themselves over there. And that was part of what it meant to be this country. But that's been lost in this rhetoric at the moment. And it is a kind of a puzzle that all of us who are liberals need to discuss, because between, you know, in 2015, because of globalization, is the first time in human history that less than 10% of the world was under $2 a day, was in extreme poverty. And that's because of the massive amount of expansion of trade and movement. You know, you quote my colleague Michael Clemens's work on you know, the role of remittances and the role that that plays and immigration plays in poverty elimination, right? It's the one of the greatest poverty eliminators in the world. And somehow we're like missing all of that at the moment for something else. But it even happens in Sweden, you know, so it's not like good, friendly Swedes are also now somewhat upset about, you know, immigration or refugee crisis. Or I was just in Austria and the same thing there. You hear that kind of rhetoric. And yeah, it is because of their policies. So you can't fix dysfunction with more dysfunction. But why is it that that seems to be, in your opinion, why is it that that seems to be the way that everyone is going at the moment? I'm going to fix dysfunction, as you put it, doubling down, as opposed to saying, geez, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think some of it has got to do with the democratic process, because I think over the years, for different reasons, various groups have found a constituency which is hostile to foreigners, to immigration, and so on. And some of it, you know, I think is generated by the fact of people movement, the fact of, you know, refugees or, you know, other foreign workers coming in, even if most of the society is welcoming of that. People coming in always affect different parts of the population differently. And so I think what's happened is that in different parts of Europe, Britain, the United States, some voices have been raised in protest. And then what happens is that in democratic politics, some parties pick up on that and address themselves to those constituencies. Okay. Now, what happens then is that those minor parties start drawing voters away from the main party. Say, if you take Australia, the One Nation Party that emerged in the early 1990s, it's very anti-immigrant. It was tiny. Okay? It actually was a coalition of people who were sort of worried about immigrants and who were upset about the recent gun control laws, because they were mostly rural people. That became quite a powerful little movement, which was powerful enough that it was taking voters away from the Liberal National Party, which is the Conservative Party. So they then adapted their policies to try to win those voters back. So they became more anti-immigrant, among other things. Labour Party then has to, you know, match that, not necessarily directly, but by moderating their policies. So in this way, a kind of anti-immigrant sensibility arises. It doesn't have to be the whole of the society. It's enough that, you know, all the parties see that they have to win certain districts if they're going to be successful. I think you can see something similar in Britain and in France and in Germany. But of course, this thing then develops a kind of momentum of its own. And after a while, okay, everybody's worried about immigration because they're now putting this issue front and center. And so then every episode that comes to light, what used to be on, you know, page 7 of the newspapers now becomes a page 1 story. And now, you know, it's very, very difficult to control the narrative and reassert, you know, principles that say, well, you know, we still believe in free movement or in free, a free society, or, you know, the right of employers to employ who they want. You're all on the defensive, and now you're playing catch up with these other things. So I think this is the way that the ratcheting effect takes place. It's not that there's a general kind of, you know, change of consciousness. It's something that happens more gradually in this way. How to undo it is another matter altogether.
Well, politics is about minimum winning coalitions, and all these people are trying to, you know, find their minimum winning coalition. And it just happens that, you know, in this age, fear is one of the things, and it switches. Again, this might not be a subtle argument for free mobility of individuals, but in the last Olympics, I remember sitting there watching it, just amazed at the tremendous talent that I'm watching and people winning gold medals in all these different sports. And then it points out that they're being educated in the United States, right? So the guy pole vaulting, you know, ends up by, he's from Sweden or whatever, but he's at LSU, you know, and this swimmer is this basketball player, and they're all, you know, all over playing for their different countries, but then they're all like, you know, sit here. So you sit back and you say, oh my God, look at the wonderment of a complete free mobility of labor throughout the world. It brings us the greatest talent, the greatest entertainment, all these things like that. But as you point out in the book, there are you know, some people who feel left behind because of this. Now they're competing not with just the guy here, but, you know, it's from over there. And then that feeds into this fear. And then you have this minimum winning coalition. And I actually have to believe that social media has some way of ginning up the fear kind of idea, and that we just haven't learned yet how to live in a world with this kind of 24/7 feed in our hands that tell us about whatever, as you said, what used to be on page 7 is now on page 1, and it's done with the most clickbaity way to us to pay attention to it. And the next thing you know, we have government officials running around trying to scoop people up. I don't want to get too political, but I have to say that during the campaign, and I heard all the stuff about what they were going to try to do with immigration, I thought to myself, I said, okay, this is insane what they're saying, but I don't think it will ever be operationalized because American people will never put up with military in our streets, because that's the only way that he could achieve the goals. This is Trump could achieve the goals that he's setting for himself, is that you had the military in the streets scooping up people. Well, what we've done is we've kind of militarized ICE and, you know, and have them do that. And there hasn't been the kind of resistance that I would have thought. And so I'm kind of like, we're more sheeple than I thought we were in some sense. And that makes me think twice about robustness of liberalism and other kind of ideas. Let me end by asking you a couple questions related to that, because I should point this out to you, is that I first became aware of your writings and thinking when I was a student. I don't know if it was IEA, but it was something like that, had a collection of what they called New Right thinkers. And I don't even think you had your degree yet. I think you were still a graduate student at Oxford, but they mentioned your work. And to me, I think that there was this groundswell of young, talented people. This is the late 1970s, early 1980s, in which people are now understanding sort of the liberal argument. They're building on the work of Hayek. It's not, as you pointed out, it's not just saying there's a definitive answer. It's that, you know, when Hayek does Law, Legislation, and Liberty, the subtitle is a restatement of the liberal principles of political economy and justice. And that whole new generation was, you know, opening up that box and then looking at it in different ways. And so to me, it was a very upward trajectory, because you end up by having, you know, Thatcher and Reagan, you know, in the early, late 70s, early 80s, and then you have the collapse of communism, and you also had the freeing up of fiscal reforms, let's say, in the Scandinavian states, because their welfare states had grown too big. You have a rethinking of development economics away from the sort of standard development planning to a much more open, and you have this era of trade and whatnot. You've been at the core of thinking about the liberal project, and we've just talked about this backlash against it, but you've made these arguments, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship that you see between your book, Immigration and Freedom, obviously, and then this book, Dialogues on Immigration in the Open Society, but then relating it to your ideal of the open society as discussed in the Liberal Archipelago. That's a big, wordy question. I apologize.
Okay, all in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I should first say something about my previous book, Immigration and Freedom. And maybe the thing to emphasize is that it's quite different from this book we've been discussing, Dialogues on Immigration and the Open Society, because it was a much more didactic book. I mean, I don't mean didactic in the sense of hectoring, but at least it had a very definite point of view to advance. And the thesis of that book was that while people are worried about immigration, especially because they worried about its impact on liberal democratic society, the thing to be concerned about that people haven't noticed is the impact of immigration control. Yeah. Because if a society is free, then it's to some extent one in which people are all equally able to go about their business without being hindered. But immigration control then becomes a danger, because if you want to control immigration, what you've got to do is you've got to control your own population. Right. And what I try to argue there is that the reason for this is that while people think that immigration control is about controlling outsiders, and often they think it's just about controlling entry into the society, the reality is that most of immigration control is about trying to control what people who come into a society might do, whether they work especially, whether they reside, whether they go to college, do all the kinds of things that they might do besides just enter as a tourist and spend money. But if you want to do that, you've got the problem that your own citizens are always trying to hire them, trying to teach them, do business with them, trade with them. So you'll have to control and monitor those of your citizens in order to control the outsiders. And this is made more difficult by the fact that, firstly, it's not easy to distinguish insiders from outsiders because they're not natural kinds. You can't distinguish them by color or language or anything. You've got to identify them. So that's going to cause a problem. And the other thing is that you're going to have to decide who counts as an immigrant, because this has always been a contentious question. What is the basis of one's nationality? Right now, the U.S. is trying to move towards a rejection or repudiation of jus soli, the law by which you become a citizen by being born, birthright citizenship of a certain kind. So all of these things become contentious. And what it does is that it pits not just citizens against immigrants. In fact, it doesn't at all, because immigrants, if they are not allowed to come in, they have no impact on you. But it pits citizens against citizens. And what it ends up meaning is that citizens will limit the freedom of other citizens. So this is something I think that immediately should raise some alarm bells, because if you want to control immigration, you're going to have to control your own citizens. And one statistic I always bring up is that, in the 20th century, the United States deported by mistake, obviously, 1 million of its own citizens, because when it tried to, go after outsiders through immigration control, it inadvertently deported 1.2 million Americans. And it continues to do so. I mean, and I don't mean this is just under the current administration. This has been going on for the last 100 years.
Right.
Okay, maybe at a certain point you could say, well, there'll always be mistakes made, but 1.2 million mistakes is a lot of mistakes. And that doesn't even include all of the citizens who are put into detention and otherwise, going to have their rights violated. So, this is quite a big deal. The other thing I think is that should be asked by any citizen is, the biggest issue for people is often the impact of immigrants on labor markets. There are people coming in and taking, American jobs or British jobs or Australian jobs. Okay, fair enough. But one thing that has to be asked is, why are American citizens obliged to hire only Americans? If you think this is a free society, what's the basis for placing this restriction on your fellow citizens? In fact, isn't it a little strange to say you can hire nobody if you want, but you can't hire somebody else? And if he says, well, I can't afford to hire an American, that's okay. Go out of business. We don't care. But you cannot hire a non-American. Isn't that a violation of that person's freedom? Of course, you can point to the third-party effects. That's what's worrying everyone. But to what extent does the concern of third parties drive policy? If you make a successful business and you drive your competitor out of business, are you harming him? Well, yes, of course you are. But, that's the way the world works. You're not obliged to make your fellow competitor succeed. Why are you obliged to make your fellow citizen better off? Leaving aside the question of whether you are really making everybody better off or just some people better off. So, all of these issues get discussed, but they're not really discussed in terms of freedom. And so that's really what I try to do in Immigration and Freedom.
Yeah, I think that's a very important part of that book, which is to make people, I think most people didn't consider the idea of the impact of the immigration controls back on our own citizens, as opposed to potential citizens somewhere else. It's not so much there. And so it's kind of like when you talk about a lot of other, you know, aspects, let's say in defense or whatever, where you end up by becoming a moral monster, right? So you're in your effort to try to address a foreign adversary, you end up by being worse than the adversary in some sense. And by having that kind of consequence aback of these policies, I think it's very powerful that you did that. I want to ask you a little bit about the Liberal Archipelago, mainly because this is a Hayek program podcast. And I don't know if you know this, but that book for well over a decade was a core reading of all of our graduate students in a it doesn't exist, the course, anymore, but was the evolution of Buchanan's constitutional economics class. And it basically was a class on liberalism. And to many people, that was their favorite book. They read Nozick, Rawls, and Walzer to start, and then they would read Buchanan and Sen, and then they'd read Kugathos on these issues. And so if you could talk a little bit about that and the way that you see, you know, your vision of an open society and the role of exit, I guess, is what we would be talking about with immigration, right? And in between the various different experiments in living.
Well, the book arose out of some work I did on topics in multiculturalism, because I was interested in the question of the claims of cultural minorities in a free society. There's a bit of an autobiographical aspect to this, because I was born and grew up partly in Malaysia, which had very strong preferential policies for the Malay population, which was a disadvantage to people like myself who were of Sri Lankan or Indian or Chinese descent. And so, you know, I was for a long time very unsympathetic to any kind of affirmative action. But at the same time, I was also very sympathetic to the claims of, you know, people like the Aborigines, which I learned about when I moved to Australia, Native Americans, who also seemed to me to have a kind of claim. And so I started to think about, you know, what would a society be like that was free, but was not simply trying to favor one kind of group over another. So what emerged was a kind of theory that said, look, you know, a free society is one in which people, you know, coexisted, but were allowed to live on their own terms, but without being either forced to live in the way of the majority or prevented from living by their own religious, cultural, and whatever other traditions. So the outcome of this was a conceptualizing of the free society as essentially one that was made up of lots of different kinds of societies, not necessarily geographically separated, but at least conceptually separated. Think of it, if you like, as another more complicated version of federalism. There were different structures of authority, some more informal, some informal. And what the society recognizes as a whole politically is that the fundamental freedom everybody is entitled to is, you know, to dissociate from, you know, those they don't want to associate with. They don't have the right to make somebody else live in the way that they choose, but they no one has the right to force them to live in the way that they want. Now, the outcome of this, I think, is always going to be that everybody compromises, because, you know, even if you wanted a society in which everybody thought exactly like you did, you're not going to find it, because there are too many areas of life in which we just differ. So we compromise and we find that best, you know, combination of characteristics that we can tolerate it. Sometimes we can tolerate it only for so long. Sometimes we are just embedded in it, and, you know, our preferences are endogenous, so we grow up just, you know, finding it very comfortable, but sometimes we change our minds. So the society that I conceptualize then is one that is pretty fluid in the sense that people do move around, but it also has lots of, you know, groups of people who are, you know, pretty stationary and so on. And I try to make the argument that, you know, this is what a free society will always look like, because people's views will change, circumstances will change. It's like an archipelago, but unlike the archipelago that Solzhenitsyn describes in his book, The Gulag Archipelago, where basically he's talking about the system of, you know, special camps in the Soviet Union where all the dissidents were held, where no one could leave. The liberal archipelago is it's a collection of different communities, but in which there's free movement among, you know, people. And this obviously speaks particularly to the issue of immigration. You know, you can't have this unless there's a certain amount of freedom. But of course, some groups don't want you to come in, and, you know, you want to recognize that they have that right as well. But the more firmly you have, and the more the number of groups you have that want to close themselves off, the harder it's going to become to have that liberal society. So in a way, and this goes to an earlier question you asked about, you know, cosmopolitanism. In a way, what you need is, you know, a certain kind of general cosmopolitan ethic. Not because everyone has to live as a cosmopolitan, but the whole has to be one that's at least, you know, minimally tolerant of the cosmopolitan outlook. You can retreat into, you know, something as narrow as an Amish community or a university. But more broadly, you know, there's a recognition that people will go where they, you know, where they're happiest.
So I'm just going to end with one last sort of question that I want you to react to, which is that and it's a conceptual clarity thing, where our good friend Dave Schmitz, in his book Elements of Justice, he argues that the key issue is to be able to have the right to say no. Which is your point about, you know, I don't have to associate that way. I agree with that. I think that's a right thing. But I've also said that I think part of the cosmopolitan attitude is to embrace the right to say yes. This is influenced by Steve Macedo's book on liberal virtues, right? And trying to create that and cultivate that. And I think this last point that you just made is the right way to think about it, which is that you have to have cosmopolitanism at the highest level of the meta norms. And then have a much more of the parochialism at, like, say, the most local level. They have to compete against each other. But when you get parochialism on top, then you can't really have cosmopolitanism down low in any kind of way. And so to me, I think we have to be able to, you know, what Peter Berger referred to this as the the kind of liberal imam. Which he says that the ideal society is one in which, this tells you how long ago it was, you go out to get your Sunday paper and, you know, at the end of your driveway, and you look to your right and there's an imam, you look to the left and you have a rabbi, and then you're in the middle and you're like a priest. And he says, and you're all like, good morning, and you go on. And so it's that kind of vision, I think, that we liberals have, but has become something of a pariah in this modern society. And you know, you've been one of the main people pushing for this pluralistic liberal society. What do you think is the prospects for hope? I mean, we all have to end with, you know, we can't say the situation is hopeless because then it would be ideal. It's like, but so what is our prospects for hope for a liberal world where we are right now moving forward?
I'm not a good prognosticator, but, you know, looking back at human history, whether you look back a little ways or a long ways, you know, things always change. And, you know, we've, in different societies, come out of far worse. I mean, when I was born, the White Australia policy was in place. You know, I could not have immigrated to Australia. I could have traveled there, I could study there, but I could not have moved to Australia. It was not until 1966 that attempts were made to dismantle the policy, which came into effect when Australia federated. in 1901, the first act of the Australian Parliament was the Immigration Restriction Act, which restricted immigration on the basis of race. So, you know, it took 65, almost 70 years for that to change, but it did. And now, you know, the idea of going back to that would be unthinkable. I don't want to say it could never happen, because all kinds of things have happened. I mean, you know, the land of, you know, Goethe and Schiller produced Nazism. So anything is possible. But I think there's no reason to think that things can't change. I think here, you know, Hayek has been an especial inspiration for me, because even when, you know, socialism was in the ascendant intellectually as well as politically, you know, he just kept at it and just said, no, and that's all you can do, really. But we have no control over events. No one does. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. But, you know, if it really was a time to despair, then, you know, I wouldn't bother writing any books. I would, you know, go and do something completely different. But I think there's, you know, there's enough reason for optimism that I will continue to write.
Well, I greatly appreciate that. Thank you very much for being with us. And I hope everyone goes out and gets a hold of this book, Dialogues on Immigration and the Open Society, and uses it in their classrooms.
Well, thank you very much, Pete. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.